You're listening to the New Churches Podcast, a production of Send Network on newchurches.com. We discuss all things church planning. If you're looking to take your next strategic step towards multiplication, you're in the right place. newchurches.com has a new look, a new host, and new resources. Take a minute and check out the Church Planning Masterclass with lessons from leaders like Matt Chandler, D.A. Horton, Trillia Newbell, and more at newchurches.com.
I'm Trevin Wax. You're listening to the New Churches Podcast. This is a podcast that is dedicated to helping church planters and the churches that send them with all sorts of timely wisdom and insights. Usually Ed Stetzer is in the seat, but today we are back with Mike Cosper, who is a writer, a podcaster. He is currently the director of podcasting for Christianity Today. You probably know him from The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. And he also has a podcast called Cultivated, both of those stellar podcasts that have engendered a lot of conversation across the evangelical landscape. He's the author of many books, Recapturing the Wonder, Faith Among the Faithless, Rhythms of Grace, The Stories We Tell. Served as one of the founding pastors at Sojourn Church in Louisville, Kentucky, from where he launched Sojourn Music. So this is the second part of a conversation about this podcast. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
In this episode, I'd really like us to focus on what church planters can take away from the rise and fall of Mars Hill, particularly in leadership and character. And before we get into some specific questions about this, I just want to tell listeners, if you are a new listener to the podcast, we'd love for you to subscribe and leave a review. Also, I'd like to just make you aware of Masterclass, Church Planting Masterclass on newchurches.com. You know, there's a lot to know before starting a church. The Church Planting Masterclass is valuable, accessible training from expert practitioners to help kickstart your church planting journey with clarity and confidence. You can find the first two modules of the Church Planting Masterclass on newchurches.com/courses. They are free. All you got to do is enter your email address. You get into those courses, and we are going to have more courses being making those available for people who join at newchurches.com. Over the next few months. So, you know, on last week's episode, we talked about the sort of the origins of the rise and fall of Mars Hill, the podcast, where the idea came from, what you hope will come from its making. This week, I really want us to focus our conversation on what church planters in particular can learn from the Mars Hill story. And so we'll start with this, Mike. You mentioned in one of the early episodes briefly that you had, you know, somewhat of an insider's view association with the story of Mars Hill Church. In fact, this is one of the things, as people have asked me about this podcast, I've said one of the reasons for its success has been not just that you have a great storyteller and podcaster in you, Mike, but that you also have someone who had a front row seat to a lot of things. So can you explain your kind of, what was your connection to Mars Hill, to church planting in that era, and why how that helped you in particular to tell this story?
For sure. Yeah. So we planted Sojourn in 2000. We were a church plant of the North American Mission Board. Thank you, Ed Stetzer, for helping us make that happen. And then it was 2003, like late 2003, 2004, we met a guy named Darren Patrick. He was planting a church called The Journey in Missouri, St. Louis. And he was part of the SBC, but he was also connected to Acts 29. He was planting through Acts 29, getting funding. And so, you know, he was telling us about, hey, there's this network. There's a lot of like-minded, you know, folks in it. We were familiar with Driscoll. I'd seen him speak at a conference a few years before. And so it felt like, oh, this would be like a great place for sort of like-minded learning, people who are trying to do very kind of specific, contextualized urban church planting. I mean, that was really what it looked like in the early days. Almost, you know, the vast majority of the churches that were planting with Acts 29 we're following in the footsteps of, you know, either Keller or Driscoll, and saying let's do cities, let's be very contextualized, let's embody the culture of the people where we are. So that, you know, that resonated. We joined in 2003, and then for a variety of reasons, I mean, Acts 29 changed a lot over the years. In parallel with some of the ways that Mars Hill changed over the years, but also just the way organizations and institutions tend to kind of evolve and change. And we changed as well. We wanted to do something that was more aligned with kind of the renewal-driven mission model that looks like what Tim Keller and City to City was doing. So we ended up transitioning out. Acts 29 sent us and about a dozen other churches out to start Sojourn Network in 2011. But anyway, through that partnership of, you know, whatever that was, 6-7 years, I got to know a lot of folks in Mars Hill, made some good friends there, and partnered in ministry with them, but also just through conversation. I mean, you know how it is, like you go out to dinner with a friend you haven't seen in a long while, and the first thing you do is complain about your boss. So we heard some of these stories, you know, going all the way back to 2005, 2006.
Right. So, okay, so let's put this in context. You've got Mars Hill, the growth of Mars Hill as a church. You've also got the growth of Acts 29 as a church planting movement. You've got the growth of your own church, Sojourn, and then the sort of outworking of Sojourn church planting that connects with Redeemer City to City. All of this, all of those you would put in the same category. If you're looking at this from the perspective of wider evangelicalism, wider evangelicalism, not white evangelicalism, but although there's some overlap there too. Right. If you're looking at broader right. evangelicalism, I guess you would say, you know, there was a lot of growth from, you know, 2000, 2015 or so of this whole young restless reform movement, this gospel-centered movement and whatnot. What are some of the factors that you would say contributed to the growth of specifically of church planting within those movements?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a couple of factors. One was there was a really significant institutional investment in church planting in the late 90s and early 2000s. A lot of that was funded through places like Leadership Network. The SBC funded a lot of it. There were some initiatives that were being driven through the PCA that funded a lot of it. But you can kind of like, you can look at sort of two or three threads. Like there's one fund that's kind of famous. I don't know if I should say the name of it, but there was one fund that was pretty famous in the, or sort of famous behind closed doors, like Evangelical Illuminati, right? This fund that, and what it did was it spun out four of the big church planting networks that kind of defined the movement for the next 10 years. So that kind of an investment, there were some people who came along and the idea that I think Leadership Network really initiated and brought to the table was, we want to fund successful churches to multiply their models. That was a break from kind of the church planting philosophy that came before, which was church planting in the past was usually sort of a denominational model. If you wanted to see church planting happen, you gave centrally to a denomination and the denomination multiplied its model that way. So I think that was a significant factor. And then I think, culture's a funny thing. Like culture has trends, and in order to have trends, you have to have trendsetters. Driscoll was a huge part of that. You know, the fact that you had, you know, cool guys like Driscoll and Darren Patrick, you know, saying this is what it means to be a real man and real man of church planters and all of that. And, you know, you heard that a lot from people who reflect on it now. Like that felt like real ministry, where going into a, you know, a legacy church or something like that felt like a cop out, because that was just kind of in the atmosphere. So I think that led to a lot of church planting as well, and maybe for the better, maybe not. I mean, maybe a lot of people went into church planting and found it to be extremely taxing in ways that were, you know, traumatic for them. So, but yeah, and then as Leadership Network, Dave Travis from Leadership Network talks about this on the podcast, actually, that as they've tracked that movement, it was in their measures, it was the most successful, Gen X was the most successful church planting generation in North American history.
Yeah, so, you know, looking at the storytelling that you've done in this podcast and talking about Mars Hill, one of the things that I appreciate that you've done is, even though obviously there's a focus on the bad and some of the scandals and the leadership abuses that were there, you also don't shy away from telling stories of people whose lives were transformed, mm-hmm. and hearing some of those testimonies. I mean, there's one moment where a guy is talking about baptizing his child. I mean, it like will move you to tears listening. And this is someone who certainly later saw through a lot of what was going on there, and yet was with this really bittersweet mixture of pride and gratitude, is trying to grapple with God being at work in the midst of what in a lot of ways was a mess. So when you've got, I mean, there anyone could look at this though and could say, okay, maybe my church planting experience, the church that I lead, we don't have the excesses that you see here, but ministry is messy, right? It's messy all over the place, and there's no perfect pastor, and anyone's going to, you know, if you're going to get stuff done, you're also going to step on people to some extent. You're going to make some people mad. You're going to have, what do you say to the guy who listens to some of this and says, yeah, thank God I'm not like that. But right. At the end of the day, the ends justify the means. If life transformation is happening, we ought to be able to put up with, you know, some of this, these negative things on the other side.
Yeah. I have very passionate feelings about this question because it comes up all the time. So I would say, number one, I think you have to come back. The question I would come back to first off is say, okay, let's define our terms. You say life transformation is happening. Tell me what that means. You know, how are you measuring that? What is your gauge for success for that? When you say life transformation, are we talking about people who are living in community and serving their church and serving their community? They're serving the poor. They're caring for one another. They're confessing their sins to each other. Or are we talking about, you know, transfer growth as membership and lots of baptisms and lots of, you know, sort of emotional decisionism, which drives the metrics of a lot of churches. They can be driven that way. I would say as well, you know, the thing you hear a lot, this is the one that drives me insane, is you hear this a lot, that, you know, when somebody's like, yeah, that pastor, they've got character flaws because of this, that, and the other, but, you know, go back and read Luther. Like, Luther was a real, you know, Luther broke some eggs, you know, to make his omelets and all that. Well, Luther was a culture warrior because literally people wanted to kill him, right? So Luther was aggressive and would like sort of make these bold stands and, you know, say these bold words and all of this kind of stuff. But he was literally doing it standing in front of a pope where there's, you know, there's probably a gallows within a few hundred yards where they'd love to string him up. And there's people with swords who'd love to kill him. So don't give me a one-to-one comparison that a guy pastoring in a comfortable suburb who treats his staff like garbage is like, well, he's just another Luther. Like, that's not an excuse, right?
Right.
Luther's combativeness was about, you know, to me, what's so fascinating about the movements of the Reformation is that the Reformation, every stage, for the most part, every stage of the Reformation is an attempt to kind of move power and transcendence and access to God and the clarity of the gospel down to the people. So, you know, we translate into the vernacular and we believe in the priesthood of all believers. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the prayer book, you know, Cranmer's prayer book, like bring all these things into the access of, so that the church can feast on the word of God and rest in the grace of God and all of this. And so to me, I just think there's so many, that we find all kinds of ways to excuse expressions of power. When power well used throughout history is liberating for the people who live under who live under the authority of the one who's expressing power. It's not the other way around. There's not a biblical ethic to say that person's abusive with their power. But we want, like, we'll put up with that because it benefits this group of people in such a way that we're happy, right? There's just no calculation for that.
Yeah. I've got a friend who says, I don't care how successful you are, no one gets a pass on the fruit of the Spirit. You know, right. You don't, like, at the end of the day, the fruit of the Spirit is evident in your life, and you could, the numbers are ultimately pointless. The fruit of the Spirit is the key. But to get practical, following up on that question about power, you know, a lot of people are talking about, well, this is why you need leadership plurality, right? You need a plural leadership model so that you can shield yourself from some of these leadership abuses. I mean, we all know situations, and they're not just megachurch situations, by the way. Like, this is the one thing that frustrates me, is I hear, you know, medium to smaller church size pastors talking about, well, I mean, can you believe they listen to a podcast like this and they take away the exact wrong lesson from it? That, well, yeah, of course, look at the mega church and how corrupt it is. And I just am like, have you never seen you know, a pastor in a small rural area who like runs the church like his own little fiefdom. I mean, like corruption of power can happen in any of these different models. But so there's been a lot of talk about leadership, plurality of elders or whatnot, whether elder led, elder rule, all those conversations about that we won't get into here. But the reality is, though, the leadership mistakes at Mars Hill, there was leadership plurality. So that in itself did not shield the church from some of those leadership abuses. So how should a church planter or a pastor who really does aspire to build a church that lasts, how can they learn from the leadership mistakes at Mars Hill and not simply rely on their model to sort of protect them from abuses?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, related to that, just a quick anecdote. I was, I invited some people to speak into the podcast, just sort of as external experts and say like, okay, help me understand what is it that protects a church from this kind of culture. And, the two main voices that I was like, these people, their insights, you know, their wisdom, et cetera, they're going to be great. The first one was an Anglican, and, you know, their sort of recommendations were like, well, the church can't be oriented around, you know, the personality of the pastor, you know, really needs to be about, the table, the Eucharist, the liturgy, you know? So basically like the solution is Anglicanism. and then the next person was like a very strong congregationalist, you know, elder-led Baptist. And lo and behold, their solution to the problem was congregationalism and healthy eldership and all of this. And I think you could go on and on and on like that. And it reminded me of an old Dallas Willard thing where he was talking about sort of similar stuff. He said, you know, he was arguing in the realm of politics. He said, you could look at sort of any political philosophy and any one of them would actually lead to utopia if everybody in the society just obeyed the Ten Commandments. And I think about that with church polity too, right? Like any church polity is probably going to function pretty well. Like most of the ones that we have, I mean, there are some that we have right now that are like innovations. And I think innovation in church governance is probably like, don't do that. Do something that's tried and true and tested. But at the end of the day, it has to be a system where there are people involved and invested that can trust one another, and that there's not, when you get the sense that someone's in the system hoping to game it so that they can control it or get what they want out of it, then you have a problem. And I think one aspect of the problem, like the reason the problem retains itself, is because we're a very slow culture to, you know, we're slow to fire pastors when they exercise these abuses, but we're also slow to like call out and discipline leaders at lower levels inside the organization. We don't want to hurt people's feelings. We really want to give people the benefit of the doubt. And so I think, you know, unfortunately in the Driscoll story, that was one of the things you see over and over again. Older leaders get around Mark. They feel a certain compassion for him. They see his talent. They see what's possible. And so they just give a ton of grace for a very long period of time, with the anticipation and the hope that on their presence, their relationship is going to get them, you know, is going to help him mature. We do that on a small scale all the time. And at some point you have to make a judgment. And if it's consistent, we're afraid to do that. But like being a human being, and again, exercising the authority that God's put us in, whether we're the leader or we're just part of a team, God puts us in those positions to make a judgment. And we are terrified to make a judgment, I think. I think that's a cultural thing.
But I think that's interesting because I think most people would say that it's making the judgment that is the problem, right? The exercise of that kind of shared power is, it's almost like we respond in some cases to the abuse of power by abandoning the rightful place for the corrective word or the rebuke or the, because we confuse what that kind of rebuke with, you know, the how dare you kind of sermon like that, thinking that's the answer when it's not. I do think that the podcast, it does hit a nerve with church planters because, you know, at heart, every church planter wants to make an impact in their community and in the world. And a lot of planters underestimate the strength of character that is required of them to endure a lot of the difficulties of church planting. You know, I think you could see some pivotal points in through the Mars Hill story when Mark responded to a difficult or stressful situation with increasingly heavy-handed leadership. I think you can see the path and the trajectory there, that once it's done here, well, then it's a new level and then the bar is moved. And then, so how would you advise a young leader, a church planter who is tempted to respond to the challenges of church planting with a sort of escalating dominance in their leadership style, and that desire also to point to the results to prove why it's the right path?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to get really specific with what you see at Mars Hill, because I think this is informative, is that at the beginning, you know, it's not just like Mark and two elders. It's three co-pastors. It's three guys planting together with a vision to reach the city. And then, you know, they raise up this body of elders, and then you get to 2007. There's 24 of these elders, and there's parity. And you can make all kinds of arguments about, like, well, how do the elders organize to do this, that, or the other? The most telling moment about, you know, that this is episode 7, I believe, State of Emergency. The most telling moment in that episode is not the decision to transform the polity and to concentrate power in an executive team. Because I would just point back to what I said earlier. I think there's all kinds of ways to organize churches, and I would probably argue there's a lot of freedom in how you organize your church. To me, the most telling moment is you have this story where Driscoll from the stage is making jokes about beating up his elders because he's mad at them because they've raised questions. And then after that sermon, they go upstairs. He, you know, blasts them with profanity and fires them, which it's questionable whether or not in terms of the governance of the church that he can even really do that. It leads to this trial before the elders where essentially these guys go before the elders and they're hopping mad, like, because of what they've just sort of endured and the shame they've endured, and the communication to the church is murky, and so their reputations are all jacked up. So they come in mad, they've been humiliated and all of this. And somehow at the end of that situation, those guys are disciplined and removed as elders, to the point where 2 months later, one of them is excommunicated from the church, and the church is told to be shunned. And all he's doing throughout all of this is going, I've been sinned against. Can you not see how I've been sinned against? And he just wouldn't back down and say, like, if he decided I'll go along to get along, it would have been fine. So to me, I think what's so important when you think about this sort of the way governance moves and changes and relationships and all this kind of stuff, I think you have to come back to the core idea as a leader in the church that I don't have to get my way all the time. If you don't believe that, right? Like, if you don't own the idea that I don't have to have all the right answers and I don't have to get my way all the time, if you don't believe that in your core, then you're going to be operating in such a way that whenever something doesn't go your way, or whenever someone challenges what you believe, you're going to start doing internal work and external work to either undermine that person or to cast that person out. And it's tough, like to say, to sort of flip the tables. I've been on the other side of this, which is your church has 75 people in it, and there's supposed to be 20 people, or there's supposed to be 15 people here to help you set up, and there's three, and you know, there's an energy and an adrenaline required to plant your church that's completely exhausting. And it sometimes that, you know, some churches that's 18 months, and some churches that's 3 or 4 or 5 years. For us, it was about 4 years where it was just Sunday in, Sunday out, a grind. So there's a need to, you know, there's a need to plow through really rough soil through a really long time in a lot of these church planting situations. What I would say though is, in the midst of that, you need to find some relationships, at least two or three, whether they're elders or whether it's just friend, like whatever it is, you need some relationships where you can go to people and say to them, how do you experience me as a leader? How do you experience me as a friend? How do you experience me negatively? And whatever they tell you, particularly about how they experience you negatively, believe them. That's the key. That's the thing. That's where I think we drop the ball. We ask people, tell me how you experience me negatively, or, you know, we invite some sort of like 360 feedback or whatever it is. And we walk away from it going, oh, they experience me negatively because of this. Well, that's because they're going through X, Y, Z or whatever. And it's just super easy to deflect instead of to go, oh, okay, how do I own this? Like not what do I need to own in this? It's how do I own this? This is me. I'm going to receive it, you know?
Yeah. Well, Mike, we'll wrap up with one last question. I just, it's easy, I think, for church planters and pastors to really have a small view of their own congregation as sort of the end all and be all of what it is that they're investing all of their efforts in. And certainly Mars Hill, even though it grew, it became this big church with all these different sites, and there's a sense in which, even though Mars Hill dissolved, and even though right now Mars Hill, Seattle is synonymous with leadership failure because of the sort of spectacular way that it imploded, there is another way of looking at this, though, in that to say, well, the short-term legacy of Mars Hill is a story. It's a cautionary tale, right? Leadership lesson, leadership failure, what not to do, what you can learn from. But there's a longer view of Mars Hill to say the real lasting impact and legacy of Mars Hill Seattle are hundreds of churches across the country that, thanks be to God, did not all have the same leadership challenges that Mars Hill Seattle had under Mark Driscoll. There are networks that have been influenced by the enthusiasm and energy around those hundreds of church plants that are not in the same network, but have been blessed and have benefited at some level. So there's a sense in which the legacy of Driscoll and Mars Hill, if you can say that there's a long-term beneficial legacy, it's actually in the movement that you see in churches across North America that, for the most part, have learned a lot from these mistakes and have also been able to spread the fragrance of the kingdom in a lot of different ways, a lot of different ministry expressions. So is there any lesson from that for just the planter that's listening that may be thinking solely about their own challenges and their own structure and their own, and to be thinking about the ways in which it might not be their own church, but the churches that their church may plant where you may see impact in the future?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember hearing Mark Dever years and years and years ago say, we have no reason to believe this side of, this side of heaven. We have no reason to believe that any of our churches are meant to last forever. Our churches often have, like historically, churches almost always have some kind of life cycle. It may be 75 years, it may be 150, it may be, it may be 15 years. I mean, there are church plants there. I can name some church plants that happened in Louisville that maybe lasted 3 to 5 years. And the fruit of that church plant was four guys that went and planted churches, So I think, those long-term outcomes to me, part of what's cool about that is that it creates such a mystery about what are the long-term outcomes of our ministry. It presents an understanding of long-term outcomes that's like, you're not going to be able to know this because, you may look at your ministry and go, man, what an absolute failure. I pastored a church of 20 for 75 years and I had to mow lawns to make ends, whatever. But then like Billy Graham 2.0 was on the front row of your church for 16 years and felt a call to ministry, and you loved that kid and served him. And, when you're retiring, he's, filling stadiums and baptizing tons of people. So I think there's so much for church planners. There's so much to the call to say, keep your head down and love the people that are in the room. Don't get obsessed with the horizons of like, I really want to go here. I really want to go there. Honestly, kind of looking at the history of like entrepreneurial, evangelical church planning and entrepreneurial leadership, like I've become kind of allergic to the word vision, because it's just, it kind of goes everywhere. And it often ends up meaning like whatever the lead pastor really wants to make sure happens. Like that's the vision, and everything sort of orients around that. And it can become very distracting from like the very simple things that the scriptures call us to do. Spend our time in word and prayer, take care of orphans and widows, love and serve each other, raise up children, older women train younger women, older men train younger. It's like how, you know, sometimes we get, again, so horizon focused that we fail to create these sort of nurturing communities where people are discipling one another, and then where the church is really going out and doing sacrificial stuff for the poor. I said to a friend of mine the other day, he pastors a giant mega church, and he was like, I'm really struggling. Like, he was like, I'm really struggling because, you know, like we only know how to sort of understand like our success as a church through, you know, it's all metrics, metrics, metrics. And I said, okay, well, what if next year, like the only thing you counted was, you know, pastoral visits to hospitals and funerals. Just count that, count it for 6 months, and then try to beat it, you know, the next 6 months, and make that your ministry. See what that does to the culture of the church. I mean, I don't think he's going to do it, but I'd love for somebody to do it. It'd be fascinating to see if it, you know, how that transformed your culture.
That's really good. Well, Mike, we're very, very grateful that you would join us on the New Churches podcast. Thank you for being with us. If you're listening, you can listen to the whole Rise and Fall of Mars Hill series over at Christianity Today's website. If you are not currently subscribed to New Churches, consider subscribing. Leave a review on your favorite podcast app. I'm Trevin Wax. Thank you for joining us for the New Churches podcast.
You've been listening to the New Churches podcast, brought to you by Send Network. If you liked what you heard, take a minute to rate and review us, or share this episode with a friend. It's the best way to show your support. To find more reliable resources and to participate in the Church Planting Masterclass, visit newchurches.com.